Audio Journal is supported in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
The Worcester Regional Transit Authority, also known as the WRTA, is a regional transit system that services the city of Worcester and the surrounding 36 communities in the central Massachusetts area, with a bus fleet that includes all-electric buses, as well as many diesel-electric hybrid buses. The second largest regional transit authority in Massachusetts, the WRTA offers reliable, comfortable, and safe transportation for traveling to work, shopping, school, medical appointments, and leisure activities. The WRTA also provides paratransit service for the elderly and disabled, as well as a variety of special services for those groups in the entire service area. For more information, visit the website at www.therta.com or call 508-791-9782.
What's going on in your town is important to you. Meetings that decide your taxes, changes in laws in your community, plans for new housing and businesses, and news about schools are all vital for you to know. Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week. In addition to the news of your community and area, you'll also hear about special events, stories about your neighbors, their businesses, their activities, and more. Stay in touch with your community on Audio Journal, broadcasting to print-impaired residents of central Massachusetts.
You may not have to travel far to find fascinating sights from 1,000 years ago. Try Effigy Mounds National Park in Iowa.
There is a mound in the shape of a bear facing the direction of the Mississippi River. Prayers held, bones buried, protected.
Coming up, Terry Tempest Williams introduces us to her favorite national parks. In the American Southwest, history is still very much alive.
You don't have to find out how Native people lived a long time ago to learn other ways, you know, other cultures of the United States. You can find out how Native people are living now.
Flannery Burke explores what the Great Southwest represents to the rest of the country. And Christopher Solomon describes a hot, dusty week crossing the wilds of Utah on a mountain bike.
Some really adventurous outings that mix exhaustion with beauty.
The views are magnificent in the hour ahead. Come along. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Mountain bikes were made for the kind of rugged trip Christopher Solomon recently got back from. He spent a week crossing the desert and mountain wilderness of southern Utah on a bike tour designed to taste the almost feral spirit of the Wild West, like a modern-day Edward Abbey on fat tires. Chris joins us a little later in the hour today on Travel with Rick Steves. And Flannery Burke explains what Arizona and New Mexico represent to the nation and to each other as a one-of-a-kind region we often call the Great Southwest. Terry Tempest Williams invites us to celebrate the land and the people you'll meet at a variety of national parks across the United States. In her book, The Hour of Land, she describes the parks she's visited as breathing spaces, each with a unique personality that deserve our patronage, our respect, and our protection. By the way, our conversation was recorded before the global pandemic. Terry, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Rick.
Your book, The Hour of Land, takes us not to the obvious parks, but it takes us to some of the less famous parks. You chose about a dozen parks to introduce to us. Why these parks? Why not the grand and famous ones?
Would you believe me if I told you that I saw this as a dinner party. You know, my mother was a great hostess, and she always said, you know, pick your dinner parties very carefully, because who knows what will come out of them. So, you know, here we have 59 national parks in our country. How to choose a dozen. So I really did envision it as a dinner party. I knew who the heads of the table would be. My mother park, which would be Grand Teton National Park. The other end of the table, I knew it would be Canyonlands National Park, where we live closely to. You know, I could count on them. Then I thought, all right, who's going to be on the other end of the table holding the space that are reliable? And for me, it was Acadia National Park in Maine and Teddy Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota. I had been to them many times, and they were trustworthy. Then I thought, okay, who are the dream guests that I would want that I don't know, but I know other people who do, and we can bring them to the table? And I thought of Big Bend National Park. I thought of Gates of the Arctic National Park and Effigy Mounds. And I thought, those are my dream guests. So they came to the party. Then I thought, all right, who's the guest that you just don't want to have there? It's a family member. You know they're complicated, difficult, but you have to have them. That was Glacier National Park for me. I just thought, I really don't want to get into climate change, that glaciers are melting, and the history with the Blackfeet Nation. But Glacier National Park sat at the table. And then there were the bad boys and girls, the ones who I knew would keep the conversation interesting and honest. That would be Gettysburg, issues of slavery. That would be Alcatraz, issues of incarceration. That would be Gulf Island National Seashore, BP oil spill. And then there's always the surprise guest who changed everything, and that would be Cesar Chavez National Monument. So that was my dinner table, my dinner party.
Can I come to the dinner party?
Please.
Okay, so I just walked into the dinner party, and I'm Rick, the travel writer. Can you introduce me to a couple of these parks in a way that I'll better understand their personality and want to get to know them better?
I think I'd first introduce you to Cesar Chavez, because he changed everything for me, that national park. You know, we hear that our national parks are our best idea. It was Cesar Chavez National Monument that said it's an evolving idea. That, you know, here we have in 1916, Stephen Mather, the head of the National Park Service, who looks at his donors, Mrs. Astor, coming to Yosemite. Would she be comfortable camping? No, she would not. They build the Ahwahnee Hotel. Fast forward to 2012, we have a black president who was a community organizer who chose to honor another community organizer, Cesar Chavez.
Okay.
An evolving idea.
Over there, there's Grand Teton. Can you introduce me to Grand Teton? I understand that's where you've had so many childhood memories.
Grand Teton National Park, this is my mother park. This is the park that after September 11th, when I was in Washington, D.C., and felt that there was no solid ground beneath my feet, I went back to Grand Teton and put my hand on the flanks of her mountain and went up to Amphitheater Lake and rebaptized myself in safety.
Whoa, I want to drink with Grand Teton. But wait a minute, over there is Big Bend National Park, who I've heard is really interesting after dark.
I made a pact with Big Bend, let me introduce you, that should I ever disappear, that's where I'll be. And you're right, it is a nocturnal park where the sounds of peccary, of javelina under moonlight, sound like the tiptoeing of patent leather hooves on sandstone.
I want to be there at midnight, but wait a minute. I remember last time I was with you, you told me Canyonlands was the most beautiful place on earth and also the most vulnerable. Introduce me.
Canyonlands, if you believe the earth is flat, come to Canyonlands, to the Needles Overlook, and you will see the curvature of the earth. It is an erosional landscape that reminds us how young we really are.
Who would you introduce me to really connect with Native American culture?
Come with me to Effigy Mounds on the banks of the Mississippi River, and let's walk into this glen where there's a 215-foot wingspan of a mound in the shape of a peregrine falcon. And while we're watching this mound and swear that the wings move, a red-headed woodpecker drops down to right where the heart would be. And if you go a little bit further, there is a mound in the shape of a bear facing the direction of the Mississippi River. Prayers held. Bones buried. Protected.
Terry Tempest Williams has invited us to a most unusual get-together in which we get acquainted with a diverse collection of national parks. She describes her experiences at each of them in her latest book called The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. It's now out in paperback. Terry and her husband live close to Arches National Park in Utah. Terry's website is coyoteclan.com.
You know what's odd to me is our national park system was born in wartime, and there's a battlefield that's actually a national park. Can you introduce me to Gettysburg?
Gettysburg is the guest I least know and that I keep going to visit. I went back to Gettysburg every single season trying to get a better sense of who this guest is. And in those furrowed fields of dried wheat that vultures still fly over, one can still feel the spirits of those who were fallen.
I'd love to meet a park that just sweeps me away in the majesty of our coastlines. What would that be?
Gulf Islands National Seashore. It was there in the heat of the BP oil spill that I flew over those waters with a pilot who told me that when that water was on fire, he saw a pod of dolphins side by side by side, treading water, looking at the flames, wondering.
I want to be all alone, and sometimes a guest at a party is kind of just there in the corner, and the classic still waters run deep. Where's a place where I can appreciate solitude at your dinner table here?
Gates of the Arctic showed me what silence sounds like, stillness. When we flew into Gates of the Arctic, I felt like a moth among mountains. And it was there that we watched a grizzly bear with two cubs walk in autumn tundra, crossing a pass.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're at a national park dinner party with Terry Tempest Williams. Her book is The Hour of Land. And Terry, this is a party I'm never going to forget. And they always say don't talk about religion and politics, but I know that you've got a fire in your belly about politics and nature. And I'd like to meet one of your guests, one of your parks that's going to put a fire in my belly for the importance of waking up to where we're going with our environment. Who would I meet and who would I talk to?
You know, I would introduce you to Theodore Roosevelt National Park, and there we would walk to the Elkhorn Ranch where Teddy Roosevelt said that after the death of his wife and mother, he went there to grieve, and it was in those 3 years in the Badlands of North Dakota that he developed the character to become President of the United States.
Who would I talk to about the whole issue of civil liberties as it applies to nature?
You know, I would introduce you to Alcatraz and the exhibit by the Chinese dissident artist Ai Weiwei, and it was there that I began to appreciate. He showed me the relationship between confinement and creativity, and how crucial it is to fight for the rights of all humans and to recognize the structures of racism that do exist, even the incarceration of Hopi people who were jailed at Alcatraz and who later we saw the uprising at Alcatraz of Native people, and what a dynamic democracy we have that is chronicled in our national parks.
The issue of our day, really, in so many ways, is climate change. If ever there was an existential threat, who would I talk to at this party where I could gain that perspective?
We would meet Glacier National Park and stand before her retreating glaciers with humility, with resolve, and with a devotion to stand in the heart of change with as much resolve as we can to do what we can with the place where we find ourselves now.
Is it conceivable that the day will come when Glacier National Park would be more properly named No Glacier National Park?
I think Glacier National Park will remind us of a world we once stood in the middle of and failed to recognize as holy, And I think the gift of Glacier National Park around this dinner table is she gives us the courage to face the future, uncertain as it is, with the fortitude to face the sacrifices that are going to be required of us. We are at a crossroads. We can continue on the path we've been on in this nation that privileges profit over people and land, or we can unite as citizens with a common cause. This is the hour of land, and the time has come for acts of reverence and restraint on behalf of the earth. I would ask us to listen, hands on the earth, listen, and remember what it means to be human.
One of the best ways to truly feel the majesty of the American West is on a mountain bike tour across the wilderness. Christopher Solomon tells us about his outdoor adventure across Utah in just a bit. Next, we explore why New Mexico and Arizona can make you feel like you're in another world. We're at 877-333-7425 as we enjoy some special corners of the United States today on Travel with Rick Steves. Mention the Great Southwest, and there's no shortage of stereotypes that come to mind. A nearly alien landscape of desert mesas and adobe settlements, with some old-style trading posts, and maybe a UFO tossed in for fun. But did you know it also offers some of the oldest historical sites in North America? Right now on Travel with Rick Steves, let's check in with a native-born daughter of Santa Fe to examine how the region sees itself. Flannery Burke teaches history at St. Louis University, and she's just written A Land Apart, The Southwest and the Nation in the 20th Century. In it, she explores how images promoting the Great Southwest got started and how they stack up with today's reality. Flannery, welcome.
Thanks for having me. This is really fun.
So A Land Apart, The Southwest and the Nation in the 20th Century. When you say A Land Apart, that really does sort of define what is something that's unique about the Southwest. How do you define the Southwest, and how is it a land apart?
Well, I define the Southwest both geographically and temporally. So I say early in the book, to ask where a place is also to ask when. And the Southwest in the 20th century, I define as the states of Arizona and New Mexico, with a little bit of bleeding around the edges into border towns like Nogales and El Paso, Texas, and Juarez, Mexico, and a little bit of reaching into Utah and southern Colorado.
So 20th century was essentially Arizona and New Mexico. But if you looked at it earlier, it goes way back. I mean, we're so inclined to think of 1620 or Plymouth Rock as the beginning of things. But, and then it's kind of astounding to be reminded. That's sort of a, I don't know if ethnocentric is the right approach, but it's not a open-minded approach to the story of our country, because the Southwest goes way, way back.
It does, yes. Although it wasn't called the Southwest then. It was the North. Or, well, it depends. Once again, it depends when.
Well, yeah, if you go back to the earlier heritage, it certainly was the North, because it has a Hispanic orientation.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, I mean, if we're in the 1500s, then the Southwest is the North for Spanish conquistadors. If we're in the 1300s or the 1100s, then the Southwest is just home for many indigenous people. And people are always astonished to come and discover that Taos Pueblo has been continuously inhabited for 1,000 years. They're astonished to discover that there were Europeans here before there were Europeans in Virginia, before there were Europeans in Massachusetts.
It is interesting to think that Arizona and New Mexico were the last two states admitted to the contiguous United States. I mean, when it was the lower 48, everything was the United States except for Arizona and New Mexico. And that probably relates, it seems to me it relates to the fact that there was a stronger Hispanic orientation to those two states. Correct me if I'm wrong. You don't have that Hispanic heritage as strong elsewhere, where if you look at a map, you think, well, why wouldn't it be elsewhere? But it really is something unique in the Great Southwest. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Americans were very overt in their aversion to admitting New Mexico and Arizona into the United States. There were pockets of Spanish-speaking people in Texas and in southern Colorado, and certainly in California. But in Texas and California, particularly, Anglos, which is what Southwesterners call English-speaking people, Anglos had really overrun those earlier Spanish and then Mexican settlements. And so Arizona and New Mexico endured this really long territorial period while Anglos in Congress and territorial representatives from Arizona and New Mexico argued about whether the states were modern enough, whether they could be successfully assimilated into the United States. And it took until 1912
to convince them.
Yes.
Flannery, if we want to travel there and pick up on the Hispanic heritage and the culture that is so deeply woven into the DNA of the region, where do we go and what would we see?
It's not even necessary to get off the beaten path to see what might strike many listeners as really unusual, you know, really something from a land apart. So one of my very favorite places in Santa Fe is to be along the Acequia Madre, which is the mother ditch of the city. And this is water that is still communally managed according to Spanish and Mexican tradition. The Acequia Madre is just a block away from Canyon Road, which is where tourists love to go to look at the art. And so it's not hard to walk that one block and see what is really the life of the city. And I was certainly taught as a child that water is sacred. I think all people who grow up in the desert are taught that water is sacred. But that sacred meaning to water was formalized through indigenous practices with water and then later through Hispanic practices with water. And the Acequia Madre has persevered through that 100 years of U.S. control. And while there are other ways of managing water in the Southwest, acequias are still there. And so it's not hard to go and see them.
You know, that is interesting. Just you used the word persevere. I'm always impressed by how indigenous values, indigenous passions, and indigenous spirituality can persevere through the sort of brutal onslaught of a bigger, more powerful culture that just comes in and owns everything. What are some ways that indigenous, not necessarily Hispanic or non-Anglo, but what are some of the indigenous values or spirits that persevere in the Southwest, in this land apart to this day?
Well, I think one of the best examples actually, you know, is Native people. And I know that a lot of people come to the Southwest to find out about the indigenous presence in North America a long time ago. But one of the things that I sort of realized as I was writing the book is that the Southwest is one of the best places to go to see how Native people have persevered. Phoenix has reservations on three sides. So Phoenix is one of the most Native American cities in the United States. And you don't have to find out how Native people lived a long time ago to learn other ways, you know, other cultures of the United States. You can find out how Native people are living now.
Flannery, are there actually families that can trace their roots to times even before the Hispanic encroachment on the region? Are there long-established pre-Columbian families in the Old Southwest?
Absolutely. One of the great things about visiting the Southwest now is that Native American political power, Native American cultural power, is probably the greatest it has ever been since U.S. and Spanish colonization. And so the sense of distinctiveness, I think, I'm not Native myself, but the sense of distinctiveness among Native people is just the strongest and most powerful, and their voices are the loudest that they've been in a very long time.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with historian Flannery Burke, and her book is A Land Apart, talking about the Great Southwest, specifically Arizona and New Mexico. Flannery, this is radio, and I wish our listeners could hold your book like I am right now and look at this photograph on the cover. The cover says a lot about your book, A Land Apart. Can you describe the cover?
I absolutely adore this cover for a couple of reasons. It is a roadside stand in Bitter Springs on the Navajo Nation. On the left-hand side of the stand, it says open. In the middle of the stand, there's a Kokopelli figure, a fertility figure, that's common among a lot of indigenous people in the Southwest. And then on the right, there is a picture of a beautiful, smiling, laughing woman. And her face is upturned toward just the bigness of the desert sky. And I love this image because it's beautiful. And I love this image because it shows how people find happiness in the Southwest, despite its many problems. But I also love this image because entirely by accident, when the press and I went looking for it, I had remembered that these portraits of Navajo people were done by the Navajo themselves. And I didn't remember who the artist was. And so I think I honestly Googled something like Navajo street art until I narrowed down who the artist is. And the artist is an African-American doctor from North Carolina who came to the Navajo Nation in the 1980s as a part of a program by which doctors could pay off their med school bills if they worked with an indigenous community in the United States. And he totally fell in love with the Navajo Nation. He's still there. He's still practicing medicine. I love that story because one of the themes of the book is that we need to expand. Southwesterners are who I mean when I say we. We need to expand who we think of when we think of a newcomer and what we think of when we think of belonging. And I think that the artist who produces these images, his name is Chip Thomas. His street art name is Jetsonorama. I think he totally belongs in the Southwest, but he's not who we normally think of when we think of a newcomer.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that that story is told, at least for me, whenever I look at that image, just delights me.
Well, I mean, we've got cultures coming together. We've got, you know, man and nature coming together. It's here's sort of the tide rips of society. Flannery, the subtitle, The Southwest and the Nation in the 20th Century. What do you mean by and the nation in the 20th century?
Well, there are many, many scholars who are doing absolutely fantastic work right now about what is sometimes called the Southwest borderlands or the Spanish borderlands or the Mexican borderlands. And they really treat the U.S.-Mexico border as a line in the sand. It's something that has political impact, but it is not the entirety of history. You know, that border has not always been there.
Flannery Burke's our guest today on Travel with Rick Steves. She's an associate professor of history at St. Louis University, and she's written a cultural history of the Southwest United States called A Land Apart. It's published by the University of Arizona Press. You can find links to our guests each week at ricksteves.com/radio. Hey, when you're talking about the Southwest, where did that notion of the Great Southwest come from? Was that created by some initiative for tourism or something? Do you know?
So that was created by a man named Charles Lummis. And in the late 19th century, he hit on this idea. It was a publicity stunt that he would walk from Ohio to Los Angeles. And he basically followed the route of the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railway. And he arrived in Los Angeles, and his dispatches were published in the Los Angeles Times. He later went to work for the Los Angeles Times. And then later, he worked for the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce. And he had a magazine called Out West that he published. Mm. And he had to write for a living, so he had to write a lot. And he called the portion of New Mexico and Arizona that he had passed through on his walking trip and where he had made many, many friends among Nuevo Mexicano and also indigenous communities. He called that and Southern California the Great Southwest.
Okay, so back then, and this is the late 1800s, he didn't distinguish between the more indigenous Southwest of Arizona, New Mexico, and then California. He thought it was all together. But today, that magic sort of stays distinct and unique in what you're considering the Southwest, which is those two states.
I think so. Lummis went on to found the Southwest Museum, which mm-hmm. still operates in Los Angeles, just off the Pasadena Freeway. But Southern California was repeatedly overwhelmed by waves of migrants.
Well, yes, California would have more modern Hispanic migrants, whereas Arizona and New Mexico would have more indigenous people who might be mistaken as migrants.
Right, right. And yes.
Flannery, how do you distinguish then within the Southwest between Arizona and New Mexico? Are they, from your point of view, pretty much indistinguishable, or do they each have distinct personalities?
They definitely each have distinct personalities. And the most consistent response that I have gotten from other historians of the American West about this book is, why are you talking about them together?
Right.
Because historians have actually talked about Arizona and New Mexico separately even more than they have talked about the United States and Mexico separately.
They're kind of sisters in the fact that they were the last two states in the lower 48 to be
admitted. Right, and they were both admitted in 1912.
And they're both more indigenous. Don't they have a stronger indigenous culture than other more Anglo states?
They do, and as your caller pointed out, Oklahoma has a really strong indigenous presence. The Pacific Northwest has a really strong indigenous presence, and indigenous people persevere all over the United States. But it's especially visible in Arizona and New Mexico today.
Hey, one thing interesting in your book is you point out that Santa Fe was the end of several old trading routes. You know, we think of Route 66 and that open road and the wonderful desert landscapes and everything, but it's also interesting to think of the impact of trading routes in centuries past. Talk just a little bit about the importance of trading routes and why that might have put Santa Fe on the map more than we might appreciate.
Well, Santa Fe was kind of a nexus of trade from Mexico City to the northern regions when Mexico was Spanish and later when it was Mexican. And then it was also the terminus of the Santa Fe Trail, which connected St. Louis and the area that became Kansas City with Santa Fe. So a couple of trade routes came together in Santa Fe throughout the 19th century. And
so Mexico City was actually connected with St. Louis by two trade routes who came together in Santa Fe.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
But what's fascinating for me is that then the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railway wound up kind of following the line of the Santa Fe Trail, and not step for step, but in many respects the same trail. And then Route 66, you know, kind of wound up following the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe line. And so there are these layers of travel history that one walks if one goes through Santa Fe and then, of course, westward. And if you know the Route 66 song, Route 66 doesn't go through Santa Fe, it goes through Albuquerque. But then Gallup, New Mexico, and Kingman, all the way down into Los Angeles.
Flannery, if you could just sum up things for us with an image. Let's say you're driving on that romantic, beloved Route 66, and it's a wonderful road trip, and suddenly you cross into what you consider a land apart. How do you know it's different? What happens when you enter the Great Southwest?
I think it's the sky. Whenever I speak to anyone who lives near the ocean and tells me that they couldn't live without the ocean, I say that in the Southwest, the sky is your ocean.
Hmm.
And there is a show ongoing from dawn till sunset, and then even afterwards, because the sky is so clear. You know, there are such wonderful observatories located in the southwest, so that you can see the stars. So it, you know, it doesn't really matter whether it's day or night. There is either a magic of light playing on the clouds, or there is this spectacular view of the stars and the moon that's hard to see in many other places. And the desert gives you that.
Hey, Flannery Burke, A Land Apart, thank you so much for joining us, and best wishes with your teaching and your writing.
Thank you.
You can hear more with Flannery Burke on The Great Southwest with this week's show in the radio section of ricksteves.com. Christopher Solomon rode hundreds of miles of what he calls empty, achingly scenic backcountry trails on a mountain bike tour through the deserts and mountains of southern Utah. And he thinks you could probably pull it off, too. Hear how wild the ride really gets in just a minute on Travel with Rick Steves. There are parts of America that still see very few footprints. Those are the kind of places that get travel writer Christopher Solomon excited to find his next adventure. One of his latest was a week on a mountain bike crossing the wild deserts of southern Utah. Chris ended up riding 260 miles and climbed 20,000 feet of mountain terrain as part of a custom small group tour called the Hey Duke Tour. It was named after Edward Abbey's fictional desert rat who ends up vanishing into a canyon. Chris writes about it in Outside Magazine, where he's a contributing editor. He joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us what it was like. Our conversation was recorded before the pandemic. Christopher, thanks for being here.
Oh, great to be here, Rick.
Describe just the basics of the trip, because it sounds like it's rough, but it's also a vacation. You had a sag wagon and you had a guide and so on.
Yeah, there's an outfitter who I've done some trips with who does some very thoughtful trips. It's called Lizard Head Cycling Guides, and they do some really adventurous outings that mix exhaustion with beauty, I guess I would say. And this trip, the owner really loves southeast Utah, and he wanted to do a crossing of the bottom of the state, but cut off kind of the boring bits. And so he envisioned a two-week trip in which people could sign up for 1 week or both. I chose the second week, but the two-week trip would start in Big Water, Utah, which I'd never heard of, and is over on the west side of Lake Powell, and then goes for 450 miles in kind of a rough J shape across the bottom of the state, swinging through like the Henry and Abajo Mountains, past Lake Powell again, into Glen Canyon National Recreation Area, down into the new Bears Ears National Monument, then up past Canyonlands, and then finishes with Finish Line Hamburgers in Moab.
Finish Line Hamburgers. I bet that was one of the best hamburgers you've ever had.
Oh, my God. And you just fall into a pint of beer at the local brewery.
Now, I got to say, physically, you look like the last person I would ever imagine that would take a tour. You just look like you walked right out of some sports magazine, you know, outfitters, dream come true. But you compromised the independence to do this experience with other people who you didn't know, and you actually had a guide. And you had a sag wagon where if you wanted to take some time off, you could just go ahead or leave your gear there and they'd meet you. For an independent traveler, a young, on-the-ball, adventurous, outdoors enthusiast, are you glad you took the tour?
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point. I mean, I love to go backpacking by myself. I'll go ski touring with friends in terms of outdoor kind of activities. My friends and I are fairly independent and sort of self-contained. Mm-hmm. But for trips like this, there are real benefits to going with an outfitter. On a week-long mountain biking trip, someone else carries all your stuff, and you get to just ride all day, especially in the desert where you might have to carry 5 gallons of water if you were and that's just for one day.
And then you get into camp and you've got some interesting people that you've shared the experience with. Is that a plus?
Yeah, for the most part, it's a plus. You never know who you're going to meet and stuff, but part of the magical experience sometimes is meeting new people and just having these amazing experiences along the way. But you could do a trip like this if you were a very experienced mountain biker. You know, bike packing, as it's called, is a very hot trend right now in the outdoors. But I'm not that experienced of a mountain biker. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go with an experienced guide.
I say that as kind of a leading question because I think there's a lot of very independent, capable, younger travelers that don't really properly consider the benefits of taking an organized tour, because it's good to have a guide. It's good to have the backup. It's good to have the social fun as well.
Oh, yeah. And the guide has expertise. The guide has stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guide, of course, takes care of all the logistics. When you add all that up, it's really not that expensive.
Mm-hmm. What I find when I go on a vacation. I like to take river rafting in the great outdoors because all I do is museums in Europe and so on. It's a beautiful break from that. And it's nice to have that guide who can tell the stories and answer your questions. And, you know, you've got the comforts of a tour as well. Now, when I read your article, and I'll tell you, you must have taken good notes in the midst of this epic bike ride. The sand and the thirst. Talk about the sand. I mean, it just sounds brutal.
There's a famous mountaineer in the Northwest named Fred Becky who is legendary. And he has a quote in one of his books that says, "The beauty is paid for in part with the currency of suffering." I always loved that quote, and it's an old idea from English adventurers. And the idea that the colors are always a little brighter if you've had to bleed for them. You know, and I don't take that sentiment too far because I'm...
No, but it's like if you drive up to a mountain pass, you enjoy the beauty. But if you bike up to the mountain pass, you probably really enjoy the beauty.
I think we can all relate to the idea that if we've had to earn something, the taste is that much sweeter. And I'm a
pile
big...
of bread and spam tastes really good if you've been hiking all day.
It sure does. And so, you know, I'm not an incredibly hard man athlete, but I really enjoy these things where you get out and test yourself a little bit during the day. And the view is that much greater at camp.
So you got the sand everywhere. And then you're thirsty. You wrote about how tongues grow thick and conversation ceases.
Well, we had this epic day on actually the first day of the trip. To be fair, the guides tweaked the trip afterwards to make it a little less arduous. But you can go in the desert from these just almost sublime, rhapsodic sort of experiences. And then everybody runs out of water and the sag wagon didn't show up where we thought it was going to. And suddenly everyone's out of water and it's dusk and you've suddenly gone 45 miles and you're done, and you don't feel like going any farther, and the mood changes just like that. And
conversation ceases, and then tailwinds become headwinds, and the sun is an anvil overhead. These are experiences that you earn.
There's a great line, and it's a line I'd heard before in the outdoors that one of the guides repeated. He says, you know, this is what we call type 2 fun.
Type 2 fun, so there's two kinds of fun.
Yeah, and I said, remind me, type 2 fun? And he says, yeah, it doesn't have to be fun to be fun.
Well, in that sense, this was a great trip.
Yeah. And you know, and there are moments like that throughout the day. So there are highs and lows throughout these trips. And I find that that's part of the real pleasure of them, too, is like realistically, life isn't just this constant highlight reel. There are moments of ecstasy and then you're down in the dumps again and you're not sure you're going to get out. But then you pull out again. And I think that's life. And that's also what makes these trips so special.
You know, you had an option. You could have spent, I would bet, less money by flying to Mazatlan and being on a beachside resort with a little plastic strap on your wrist and get all the margaritas you want. And it would have been easier, and it might have been type 1 fun.
Yeah.
But I think as far as embracing life and having a forever vivid experience, this one would top that hands down.
I think I said in another piece once, I think beaches are morgues with better lighting, I mean, to me.
Beaches are morgues with better lighting. I got to write that down. Christopher Solomon's our guest today on Travel with Rick Steves. Chris is a contributing editor at Outside Magazine. Christopher, let's talk about the biking environment. What were the roads like? I understand you actually found stream beds to sometimes be the best place to bike. And then what was the actual bike like?
Yeah, well, here's what was interesting about this trip, Rick, is you didn't have to be some exceptional mountain biker, and I'm not. John Humphreys of Lizard Head had stitched together this route. It was a skein of old ranch roads, mining roads, occasionally logging roads up on the mountaintops, often old wide gravel and sand type roads. It wasn't aggressive, you know, single track, as they call it in mountain biking. Mm-hmm. You had to be incredibly skilled. You just had to be, you know, a little bit careful for those, the sand and the deep washes and stuff like that. But often in the desert country, the flattest thing around is an old stream bed. And stream beds do what stream beds do when it rains. And so they could be pretty rutted. They could be filled with boulders. And so we took the latest mountain bikes. And mountain bikes these days are things of wonder. I mean,
so you could have a rocky stream bed and you could actually find that a workable road because of the modern bikes that you had. Big tires, hydraulic posts on the seats to absorb the shock.
Oh, they're just as plush as a Cadillac these days. The seats will go up and down to lower or raise your center of gravity to keep you nice and comfortable and safer. The tires now for some of these bikes are 3 inches wide. I mean, they'll practically surf on some of the sand. They'll make you so much better than you think you are, which is going to be dangerous, actually.
And all your gear is in the wagon, so it's going ahead, except you've got a little day bag on with your water.
Yeah, you're carrying enough for safety for the day because you're not sometimes sure how much you're going to meet the...
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Christopher Solomon about his adventures on a mountain bike going across a remote corner of Utah. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Joe's calling from New Hampshire. Hey, Joe, do you have a comment or a question for Christopher?
Yes, I have a question. My wife and I are both have on our bucket list to do some mountain biking. And listening to the conversation right there, the question is, what is the best way for us to get in shape for doing a trip like that, and what type of accessories would you suggest that we take with us?
So a couple questions there. The first one, I would suggest there's nothing like doing. So I don't know how much you have the chance to just get out and ride your bike. And if you can't be riding, and I'm not trying to be simplistic about that, but getting out and just getting in the saddle, and if you can't get on your mountain bike, get in a spin class 4 days a week. I live in the city of Seattle, and I'm in the gym riding a stationary bike more often than I'd care to admit. You need that saddle time, too. There's nothing worse than getting saddle sores about a day and a half into a long trip like that. It's very uncomfortable.
You get a saddle sore, and it's probably not going to go away for the rest of that vacation.
No, it'll go. It might go away right near the end, but it might not, and it could get worse. So you just need, you know, butt in the seat time. Just find time to ride several days a week, and even if it's at the gym, would be my first suggestion. The second one, you asked about what kind of accessories. A good outfitter will provide a long list of gear that you need. I mean, were you wondering about anything in particular?
Just in general, that's all. I'm not even sure where to begin when I think about a trip like that.
Well, probably a big deal is if you're going to take a tour or go on your own.
Yeah, the biggest thing I would just suss out for a trip is just make sure you're comfortable with the ability level of the tours that you're thinking about. I guess that would be just make sure you're not in over your head and really ask a lot of questions of the tour operator. I have been on one or two where people do get a little swamped.
Bite off more than they can chew physically.
Yeah.
All right, Joe, thanks for your call.
Thank you very much for taking it.
Okay, good luck on your next mountain bike trip. Laura's calling from Texas. Hey, Laura.
Yes, hi.
Thanks for your call. Do you have a question or a comment for Christopher?
Yes, I do. I've been reading Desert Solitaire, the book that Edward Abbey wrote in the 1960s. And I was inspired by a section in which he proposes that, so he was a park ranger, but he proposes that park roads should be limited to pedestrians, park buses, or bikes, allowing people to be liberated from the automobile. He uses the word liberated. And I have experienced that freedom in Denali National Park, where you really can't get very far into the park unless you park your car at the entrance and then you take a bus in or you walk or bike. And so he says at one point, a man on foot, on horseback, or on a bicycle will see more, feel more, enjoy more in 1 mile than the motorized tourist can in 100 miles. So my question is to your guest, if he knew about that proposal and if that informed his desire to plan a bike trip.
You know, I have read Desert Solitaire, but it's been a long time ago. I was reading some Abbey in preparation to go down there because it's sort of the vade mecum, right, of this desert Southwest. And you've got to read some of him before heading into his land.
Edward Abbey.
Yeah. And, you know, he was a little bit contradictory, though. You know, he does say in a couple of his things, you know, people slide through this country now. What slick as grease. But then he would take some backcountry roads for 2 weeks with friends in an automobile, in an old truck. But I have heard about some of these proposals. Philosophically, I'm in favor of them. I do understand that some people can't move around as easily as the rest of us. So I understand some of the pushes and pulls on either side, but I'm certainly sympathetic to the idea of more people getting out and seeing it by bike. You slow down more. You really do. You roll down the window. As I think he says in one of the essays I was reading, he goes, "Roll down the window, lady. That smell, it's the desert." So, yeah, I mean, I certainly understand. I don't think realistically we're going to be able to shut all the roads in Mount Rainier National Park and give people rent-a-bikes anytime soon. But I like the idea of maybe trying it more.
And just the agreement that philosophically, you know, ideally, if you get out and walk or bike, you'll experience more. And even if you're going by car, you can factor that into what you're able to do physically.
Yeah.
Laura, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Christopher Solomon about his mountain bike ride in Utah. And Christopher, let's just wrap things up here with some of the simple joys. I mean, you're caked in dust and you finally get to a shower. That must be an amazing, nice feeling.
You know, these trips always have a certain progression, Rick, I find, where you get out there and at first you can't almost deal with it. You're still in civilization mode, city mode, and you're uncomfortable, you're hot, you're sweaty, you're sticky.
Because I can't go to bed at night without taking a shower if I'm a little bit sweaty.
Right?
You've got to get over that, I guess.
Yeah, but about a day and a half in, you forget about your cell phone. You start to forget that you're all hot and sticky. The food, everything you're fed tastes like filet mignon, and just something just starts to happen to you. And
you actually forget that you're sticky and sweaty.
I mean, you kind of do.
You haven't washed your hair, and you don't really care.
Oh, you don't even remember you have hair. And you do get a solar shower. Someone's hung on a juniper tree, and it's been baked by the sun, and suddenly you've got hot water about 3 days in, and you're only able to scrub off like the top two layers of dust, and it still feels just magical. And then you put on a clean pair of socks, and you could be a king. It's really just a really
And you climb into bed, and you got the stars overhead, and you can watch the weather coming and going, and you got the bugs. I mean, what's that like?
Oh, and you kind of wonder what the rich people are doing tonight because there's no one richer than you, you know.
Really? And then in the morning, a cup of coffee?
Oh, and you just sit and have a cup of coffee and watch the sun come up over the Red Rock country. There was one time we were at the edge of a place called the Dark Canyon Primitive Area, one of many areas I'd never even heard of before. And I consider myself a fairly well-traveled adventure writer. Uh-huh. And we just sat there for hours, you know, sipping a beer at the end of the day.
A beer? Sitting around the campfire?
A cold beer.
You wrote about sparks going up toward the Milky Way.
Yeah. Once in a while, someone would try to say something about how beautiful it was, this mini Grand Canyon at the foot of us. And everything we said just was so insufficient that you just shut up again and just stare some more and just try to remember it.
You know, the sad thing to me just kind of overcame me. People go through their entire adult lives and never even get close to that experience.
Yeah.
And it's their choice. You can make that choice.
And you don't... one thing I would want to emphasize is I'm reasonably fit, but I'm not as fit as my friends think I am, or not as adventurous as people think I am. Like, people can do this stuff with a little bit of effort, a little bit of an adventuresome spirit. I mean, it was a guided trip.
Yeah, you wrote about Kevin, one of the guys on your trip, and you said it was the seventh and last morning, and he said, "I never want these trips to end." That must be a special camaraderie and a special satisfaction when you've made the point to do this and you've been caked in dust and you've enjoyed sleeping under the stars and
and for a week he was able to step away from his very busy life with a couple kids and a wonderful wife, and he fully escaped and just wanted to keep going like Edward Abbey's character Hayduke.
Okay, so you've done this. It sounds like a real triumph. How do you follow that? If you had a great dose of mountain biking and the great outdoors in Utah, what would be next for you in your mountain biking travel dreams?
In the mountain biking travel dreams?
Well, just in the same sort of genre where somebody else is carrying your gear and you've got 1 week off and you want to get close to nature and appreciate the bright vastness of the Milky Way.
I haven't thought of a good next mountain biking trip. There's still more road biking related supported trips I'd like to do.
Well, what would that be?
There's all sorts of stuff you can do through the Rockies. There's supported trips through the Alps where you eat like a king and you ride mountain passes through the Alps, like following the Tour de France.
That must be trendy because I know that's a big deal in river rafting is gourmet eating and beautiful. Mm-hmm. Appreciation of the great
and course. You earn it every day.
And you earn it. Like you said, everything tastes like filet mignon.
In that case, it is.
So much fun. Hey, Christopher Solomon, thank you so much. And again, we can read your article in Outside Magazine.
Thank you.
along with a tumbling tumbleweed.
What's the scenery been like where you've been traveling? Send us a short impression from your travels in an original haiku poem. Details for sending us yours are in the radio section at ricksteves.com. Here are some interesting ones that have come in lately that we thought you might enjoy.
Colin Lumen from Portland, Oregon, shares a sight that has stayed with him from a visit some years ago to the desert southwest. Northern lights, I saw. New Mexico, March 03. Sunstorms drove them south. Lynn Gerner of Wailuku, Hawaii, reminds us that Maui's Central Valley shouldn't be overlooked by the island's many tourists. Sun descends, wind gusts. Sugar cane sways, gilt green in ephemeral blaze. And Mark Cohn from Beverly, Massachusetts, sends us this haiku he wrote after a visit to Quebec City. How to get back up to the top of old Quebec? Ah, the funicular.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kaz Merhall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling manages our website. Radio affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. We have studio help this week from WFRD at Dartmouth College and Stepbridge Studios in Santa Fe. Gretchen Strauch read this week's listener travel haiku. Listen again whenever you like at ricksteves.com/radio.
Do you need to contact the Massachusetts Attorney General's Office? The Attorney General's Office deals with a wide range of issues, including elder services, civil rights, fair labor, health care, insurance and financial services, housing, open meeting laws, public charities, and victim compensation. If you aren't sure who to call, an information specialist can direct you if you call the main switchboard. The main switchboard is 617-727-2200. Once again, that's 617-727-2200.
This is Bird Note. Many flowers roll out the red carpet for desired visitors like hummingbirds and bumblebees, with bright colors and petals that act as landing pads. But flowers are sometimes victims of nectar thieves, species that bypass the flower's intended route to nectar without picking up any pollen. Tennessee warblers might not look like crafty robbers. They're tiny yellowish songbirds with a white stripe over their eyes. But they specialize in hacking into flowers. With their short, sharp bills, they tap a hole into the flower's base and enjoy an easy meal as nectar drips out. Tennessee warblers do most of their nectar drinking in tropical forests on their wintering grounds. During the breeding season in North America, insects are their most important food source. In fact, these warblers may help protect trees from spruce budworm. When there's a budworm outbreak, Tennessee warblers eat almost nothing else. So these nectar thieves give back to their ecosystems in their own way. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Tom and Annalie Lumen celebrate Bird Note with today's show. They believe Bird Note stories are a magical doorway to nature and all of its wonders.
WICN Public Radio is a proud partner of Audio Journal. Audio Journal provides news, information, and entertainment to visually and print-impaired residents of central Massachusetts. Audio Journal broadcasts are made possible through the use of a portion of WICN's broadcast frequency. 90.5 WICN is Worcester's only NPR affiliate and the voice of arts and culture in central Massachusetts. Visit WICN.org for more info.
Did you know ADA paratransit riders in Worcester, Auburn, Boylston, Leicester, Northborough, Oxford, Westboro, and West Boylston now have the option to schedule trips through the Worcester Regional Transit Authority's new online reservation system. Call customer service at 508-791-9782 or email paratransit@therta.com to begin scheduling your trip online.